This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. You may recall from school that Indiana elected a Klansman as governor in the 1920s. At least that's how I remember it. Some Indiana students aren't even taught that part of our history. When we look closer, as often happens with history, we see that the truth is a little more complicated. How did a group like the KKK gain so much power in the Hoosier State? And who and what were they against? Today, we welcome Jim Madison, Professor Emeritus of History at Indiana University and the author of the new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland. Jim Madison, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Matt. Thank you.
And a quick note before we get going. This is an encore presentation of a show we aired last month, so we can't take your questions and comments live, but we would love to hear from you. Let us know what you think. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and you can leave us a high-quality audio message with our smartphone app, All In Vox Pop. So let's start with some context, Jim. You write that the Klan had three significant movements since it was founded. What were they?
Well, it's very important to separate out the three because failing to do that causes immense confusion. The first, the earliest, is right after the Civil War, and it's entirely Southern by Southerners who were very upset about the results of that war and about emancipation and wanted to keep African Americans in their class, in their place. No sign of that in Indiana. The third Klan, let me come back to the second. The third Klan is the one that revived after the civil rights movement began in the 1960s. We might want to talk about that later. The big Klan for Hoosiers is the Klan of the 1920s, the one between these two chronologically, the one that had by far the most power, the most influence, and the most numbers in Indiana.
How did they look different from that original Klan? Was it a softer Klan than that original Southern Klan?
Softer, yes, in the sense that they were not as attuned to violence in the 1920s in Indiana. The Southern Klan in the 1870s and again in the late 20th century was often a very violent organization. Hoosiers tended to stay away from violence, even in the Klan in the 1920s. There were some lynchings in Indiana, but I don't know of any Klan lynchings in the state of Indiana. But it's different in the 1920s in Indiana in so many other ways. Indiana is not the South. And the Klan of the 1920s is a Midwestern Klan, which is why I use the word heartland in this book. It's good Hoosiers.
And would you say that Indiana was among the more significant examples of that Midwestern Klan influence at that time, or were there others in surrounding states?
Oh, absolutely. Indiana is as significant as any other state, but the Klan was active in the North, not just in the South. This is very important. From the Atlantic to the Pacific, from Pennsylvania and Massachusetts to the state of Oregon and California, it is a strong Northern organization in the 1920s. But among those Northern states and among the Midwestern states, Indiana is probably as powerful, as well organized, as large in numbers as any other state Klan. One other aspect of the Indiana Klan that gives its significance is that we have very good documents. We have very good records about the Indiana Klan. And so as I was writing this book, I had excellent sources, membership lists, newspapers, court documents, oral histories, all kinds of sources at places like the Indiana Historical Society, the Indiana State Library. And for a historian like me, that's just a joy. You know, we can't make it up. We need sources. And I know you've read this book, Matt. I'm grateful for that. If you look carefully, you see that there are lots and lots of pages of notes at the back of this book. Most people won't know that, won't read those. But for scholars, for historians, it's essential that we have facts, that we have sources, that we document them.
And indeed, you do. There are references throughout the book, numbered references, and it is a comprehensive history, especially of that time. What did the KKK stand for at that time in the around the 20s, just before the 1920s in Indiana?
Well, they thought Indiana was going to hell in a handbasket, and that's one of the titles of one of the chapters in this book. They believed that Indiana was a downhill slide. They believed that there were enemies at the gate and within the nation. The Klan was very good at identifying enemies and explaining why these people were causing the downfall of moral and political values, taking America away from its true origins, its true purpose and future.
And how did the Klan find its way to Indiana? I mean, obviously there were Hoosiers who signed on, but who took the message of the Klan to Indiana in the latter half of the teens?
That's right. There are some signs just after World War One, and World War One is very important because that war really sets the foundation for the Klan. It's a war that lets loose intolerance. It's a war that lets loose hatred and xenophobia and isolationism and kind of shutting down. And the Klan picked up on that. The Klan is exceptionally good at picking up on currents that are in the air, bigotry and hatred and prejudice of various sorts, and of magnifying, of packaging them, and of marketing them.
And how did they manage to bring an organization like the Klan, which we see, you know, in so many historic filters today as a very bad organization, and I don't think that there are too many people who would disagree with that, even in the context of history, especially I guess with the context of history. How was it that they were able to bring these ideas mainstream? You don't just do that by holding angry marches.
No. And that's a very good question, Matt. And it relates to your opening comments about the complications of this subject, because here we have a great contradiction. Many people see the Klan today as simply a hate organization. And it is full of hate by our standards today, and we would all reject it and its ideals, I hope. But in the 20s, the Hoosiers who joined the Klan thought of themselves as good Americans, of religious and patriotic and moral and just, and they were going to save America through the message and the means of the Ku Klux Klan. That's a contradiction. And that was one of the major challenges in writing this book, explaining that contradiction to readers.
Who was joining the Klan? What kinds of people?
Well, we know a lot about that these days. The old myth, and it was a comforting myth. There were a lot of comforting myths about the Klan in Indiana. We now know that about a third of native-born white men in the state joined the Klan. That's a lot of Klan members. We know that they were Protestant. You had to be Protestant, Methodist, Baptist, Christian. You had to be white, and you had to be native-born. And those people who were therefore qualified to join called themselves 100% Americans. They were true Americans. They were real Americans. Everyone else was less than 100%. And the Klan went to great, great means to push that point, to make that point. Everyone else was really the enemy, the others, them, the causes of the problems.
And who was at the near the top of the list of the everyone else's?
Well, here's another myth that's often circulated still today. The number one Klan enemy were Catholics. And that's hard for us to understand today because we've moved past the time when anti-Catholicism was deep, deep, deep in Protestant religions. It certainly was in the 1920s. There was a strong tension among Protestants against Catholic believers. They just thought that church and its Pope were a foreign church. They were up to no good. There were conspiracies to take over public schools, to take over the government. There were notions that in Catholic Church, they stored rifles in the basement for this revolution that Catholics were proposing. It's preposterous. But there were good Hoosiers who believed that stuff in the 1920s. So anti-Catholicism makes Catholics the number one enemy. There are large numbers of them in Indiana. Also, many of them are immigrants, and immigrants are also the enemy because immigrants, especially from Southern and Eastern Europe, are just not 100% Americans. It's not even certain that they're really white people. All kinds of anti-immigration prejudices added to Catholicism. And then moving down the list, African Americans. It hardly needs be said that African Americans were second-class citizens, that segregation, discrimination in Indiana against African Americans in Indianapolis and Evansville and Fort Wayne was deep, deep, deep. African Americans were the enemy, and Jews were the enemy. Anti-Semitism is deep. All these people, Catholics, immigrants, Jews, African Americans, are not 100% American. And the Klan was very good at, at creating this racial hierarchy. White people at the top, of course, and then down the ladder, all sorts of lesser peoples. The pages of the Klan newspaper, the Indianapolis Fiery Cross, are full of diatribes against these enemies, who they are, why they are, and why they need to be put in their place.
And there were also a number of social norms that they were against as well. Among them, I guess, they were proponents of prohibition, right? Alcohol was very bad to the Ku Klux Klan.
Prohibition was a major factor in recruiting new Klan members. The federal law, the 19th Amendment, was in effect, but it wasn't enforced, at least not adequately. And so the Klan insisted it be enforced, and when they thought it was not being enforced, engages in their own enforcement along highways and roads, stopping bootleggers, raiding gin joints and other places of not just alcohol consumption, but all kinds of other immoralities. The Klan believed it was a reform organization to clean up corruption, alcohol, sex, backseat sex. You know, this is the great age of backseat sex because young couples get to buy a used Ford and they go parking along Lover's Lane. Well, the Klan was abhorred about that and went out and raided these kinds of Lover's Lanes and show flashlights into the back seat and on and on.
We're spending the hour today with IU history professor emeritus Jim Madison talking about his new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland. And we'll talk a little more about what the KKK of the 1920s and the late 19-teens were against when we come back. I'm Matt Pelser, and we're back in under 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we have Jim Madison, professor emeritus at IU and author of the new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland, which is mostly about the Klan's influence on Indiana in the early 20th century. And a quick note, this is a repeat of a show we aired last month, so we can't take your questions and comments live, but you can always reach us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and you can download our smartphone app to send us high-quality voice messages for the show. Just search for All In Vox Pop. And just before the break, Jim, we were talking about prohibition and how much the Klan supported it. The Klan was also against women's suffrage to a degree. And you quoted an article from the Fiery Cross, their newspaper, which was headquartered in Indianapolis, and it read, "Giving her the ballot would foster masculine boldness and restless independence, which might detract from the modesty and virtue of womankind." But ironically, one of the Klan's most vocal supporters was a woman named Daisy Douglas Barr. Who was she?
Well, Daisy Douglas Barr is a very interesting figure. She started off as a Methodist and then became a Quaker and became a Quaker minister. She traveled around central Indiana preaching. And then in the early 20s, she discovered the Klan. She became a major Klan recruiter and organizer and speaker. She also became vice chair of the Indiana Republican Party, a real leader, a real fundraiser, a real recruiter. She's a fascinating figure. And she's an example of women in the Klan. You're right in suggesting the Klan, the guys in the Klan really struggled with women because some of these women had participated in the suffrage movement. They were sort of getting out of their place, moving into politics, moving into the public sphere. The Klan didn't want them as members, but allowed them, these women, to create their own women's clans. We have male claverns in every one of Indiana's 92 counties, probably women's organizations as well. They're very active, these women's groups. They play a very important role, but the men of the Klan are often a little bit uncertain about women in the Klan, women getting too powerful, women getting outside of their place.
Daisy Douglas Barr was a Quaker minister, and the Quakers are often associated or known rather as a particularly progressive wing of Protestant Christianity. Did she remain a Quaker minister once she began associating with the Klan?
Yeah, she combined both these roles. And the Quakers have a deserved reputation for their progressivism, anti-slavery before the Civil War and today in other ways. But at this point, the Quakers had become a little less progressive, and there was a strong Klan presence among Quakers, especially in central Indiana.
And there were a lot of other changes at that time. You mentioned automobiles becoming more commonplace. People were also going to the movies. There was new music that people were concerned about. What was the Klan's opinion on that, the media of the day?
Another complication, Matt, because a lot of this new stuff, automobiles, backseat sex, Hollywood films on main streets in Indiana were full of suggestive stories with flappers behaving in ways that the Klan abhorred. So film really bothered the Klan. On the other hand, and this is exceedingly important, I believe, to understanding the Klan of the 20s. These guys were not rubes. They were not ignorant, unsophisticated. Quite the contrary. The Ku Klux Klan made its own films. One made in Indianapolis, one made in Columbus, Ohio. They showed across the Midwest. These are silent films, of course. They know about that technology. They make phonograph records. They publish their own newspaper. They have these performances of parades and rallies. The Ku Klux Klan were marketing geniuses. They figured out how to sell their product, and for a short time, they did an excellent job selling it.
And they recorded some of that music at Gannett Studios in Richmond, the historic studio there that was known for recording African-American artists in the jazz world.
You can't make this stuff up. I love the ironies of this because, yes, they did. There are Klan records recorded at that studio along the Whitewater River in Richmond, Indiana. Lots of Klan records. And there are also jazz and early African-American recording. King Oliver shows up there. There's a possibility that he and Louis Armstrong and others who recorded in Richmond passed Klan members in that studio as they were recording their different, very different kinds of music.
It was all about money to Gannett at that time.
Well, it was.
Whoever had it, they would take it.
That's right. It's business, you know, and you're a customer. We don't care what you're promoting or what you're selling or what your songs are. We'll record you.
And the leader of the KKK in Indiana was D.C. Stevenson. Who was he?
Well, Stevenson's story is a fascinating one, and it has pulled Hoosiers in for a long, long time. I tell that story. I've got a whole chapter on Stevenson because it's an important story. But I want to say one thing before I briefly tell the story, and that is that the spotlight on Stevenson as Indiana's grand dragon, I believe, has obscured other aspects of the Klan that are probably more important, the questions we've been talking about. The ordinary Hoosiers who joined this Klan and why they joined and what they were up to, the damage that they did, the possibilities that they opened up. That's all, to me, at the center of understanding the Klan. Now, Stevenson is part of that. In a short summary, I believe that D.C. Stevenson is among the most evil human beings who ever walked the soil of Indiana. He was also a very smart salesman, and he had a salesman charm. He also had a good eye for the buck, and the Klan in Indiana made hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars selling dues, selling robes and regalia, and in other ways, gathering up cash, gathering up income, and using it for their own purposes. And it was Stevenson's brilliance, in part, that made that happen. He, of course, had his downfall, a very sordid downfall, full of details that we now know a lot about that. He brutalized, raped, and murdered a young woman from Irvington, Madge Oberholzer, who left a deathbed confession that clearly caused Stevenson's trial and conviction. And in late 1925, Stevenson is sent to the state penitentiary in Michigan City.
All right, and we'll get into a little more on the fall of D.C. Stevenson and then the subsequent fall of the KKK in Indiana later. D.C. Stevenson was also a little hypocritical when it came to what the KKK stood for and what he did in his private life. Tell us about that.
Not just a little, a lot. Here's this organization against alcohol, against sex, against sin, and all kinds of other corruptions. And D.C. Stevenson bribes officials, local and state officials, using money to convince them to do what he wants. More sinful, I suspect, is his lifestyle. He had huge parties in his yacht on Lake Erie and at his house in Irvington, where the booze flowed and where young women were invited as guests that lasted long into the night. He engaged in all kinds of sex and relationships with other women. He had numerous girlfriends at the same time. And he, in some ways, was a drunkard. He may even have been an alcoholic. He certainly enjoyed drinking. So all of this is a deep contradiction of the values the Klan preached to its members.
We're talking with retired history professor from Indiana University, James Madison, author of The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland, which is a new book that is out now. And we'll come back to D.C. Stevenson, but I'd like to touch a little bit more on, as you put it, the common man who supported the Klan, who were perhaps members of the Klan, and some of the events that the Klan put on. Indiana was home to, as you put it, the grandest Klan spectacle in U.S. history. What happened on the 4th of July in 1923?
Well, this is a great conclave in Kokomo, as it's called, and it was very well organized. It's indicative of the sophistication of the Klan in putting on these kinds of events. It was a multi-day affair around the 4th of July in 1923. Thousands of Klan members from all over Indiana and across the Midwest arrived on trains and interurban cars and automobiles to Kokomo, Indiana, to Malfalfa Park, where they engaged in the usual sorts of things that Hoosiers did in the summer at a Sunday school picnic or a family reunion. There were cookouts and picnics and walks and basketball and singing of good songs and hymns, and also, of course, Klan ritual. A big speech by D.C. Stevenson, and in the evening, a massive parade and the lighting of the cross, the great symbol of Klan ritual. A huge affair that goes down in history as one of the greatest Klan spectacles in the whole history of the nation.
And there was Klan memorabilia for sale to common people at this celebration, right? There were vendors who were selling things. What were some of the things you could find?
Oh, yes, indeed. There's always a chance to make a buck in a movement like this. There was Klan jewelry. There were earrings and necklaces and other things with KKK and other insignia on them. There were photographs. There were all the usual souvenirs that merchants supplied. You could buy them in shops in downtown Indianapolis. The Klan, again, is a marketing machine. And it was able to sell phonograph records, sheet music, jewelry, films, all the stuff that sent its message and that also helped make money.
But at Malfalfa Park in Kokomo and other events like this, although that one was the biggest one, was the outward and amplified rage and hatred at the core of the Klan's message, was it on display there? Or was it presented a little softer, I guess?
No, much softer. Let's remember, these are Hoosiers. We're nice people. We don't like to say bad things about anyone. We're friendly and neighborly. And this is a challenge for the Klan, but they're very good at this too. You can find in the Fiery Cross newspaper, for example, some harsh, harsh bigotry. But often Klan preachers, spokespeople like Daisy Douglas Barr packaged all of this in much softer, even sentimental kinds of ways. Yes, these people are a problem. We're sorry they're not better than they are. We've got to do something about them, but we don't want to kill them. We don't want to enact violence on their bodies. We're not that way, we in Indiana. So all the messages are softer, and the Klan also uses what we now know of and are called labeled dog whistles. They say things that on the surface aren't so offensive, so full of hatred, but the true believers know what the message is. It's coded, it's encapsulated in softer language.
And there were, of course, big moments of opposition to the Klan, in addition to some of the big spectacles that the Klan put on. And one of the most famous moments of opposition was a violent uprising in South Bend. What happened?
Well, there's always opposition, and we can talk about that more. But one of the most one of the best stories is what occurred in South Bend, Indiana. The Klan swept to victory in the Republican primaries in 1924 and celebrated with a huge parade around Monument Circle in downtown Indianapolis, and then planned this massive rally in South Bend. When the students at Notre Dame learned about it, they started to get agitated. But Father Walsh, the president, said, "No student's going to leave the campus and go down there and get into trouble. You must stay on the campus." Well, like good college students often do, they did not obey the administration, and they ran downtown. And like good students with a sense of humor often do, they misdirected the traffic as the hundreds and hundreds of cars carrying Klan members arrived in South Bend, sent them in the wrong direction. And then they started to engage in a little bit of physical altercation. They tore off some robes and hoods. There's a wonderful picture in the book of a Notre Dame student from Fort Wayne proudly wearing a tattered robe and a tattered hood as a trophy that he had acquired. Maybe the best story about this so-called Notre Dame riot, and that's what the Klan called it, is that the Klan headquarters were on the third floor of a downtown office building, which had a large electric cross in the window. And there was a barrel of potatoes in the storefront there, and the students started to get those potatoes and throw them up at the light bulbs on the cross. And the story is that the quarterback on the Four Horsemen of Notre Dame got the potato and threw it up and hit the last light bulb on that Klan cross. That story, I want to be quick to say, is almost apocryphal, but you sure want it to be true.
So let's look a little bit at that big victory, the 1924 Republican gubernatorial primary. You've got Indianapolis Mayor Lou Schenck, who was a strong critic of the Klan, and right. Edward Jackson. Who was he?
Well, Jackson is a veteran of World War I. He's a sort of businessman from northern Indiana, one of the ordinary Hoosier politicians of the 20s. One of the points I make in terms of context here is that for whatever reasons, the political leadership of the 1920s was mediocre. It may be, it's hard to judge this as a historian, but it may be the worst generation of political leaders we've had. Mediocrities, second and third rate mediocrities with almost no exceptions. And Ed Jackson is the exemplar of that mediocrity. He's a do-nothing, interested only in getting elected, and he sees the way to do that in forming an alliance with Stevenson and the Klan, which he does. He carries money for Stevenson to offer bribes. And with Stevenson's backing, he wins the Republican primary in 1924. He did defeat the anti-Klan mayor of Indianapolis, Lou Schenck. That's the end of Lou Schenck's political career. A popular mayor who had stood up to the Klan, who had opposed cross burnings in the city and parades in the city. And Schenck goes down in flames. Jackson rises to victory and is elected governor in the November general elections. I believe firmly that Ed Jackson is the worst governor the state of Indiana has ever had for all sorts of reasons, above all, his close alliance with the Klan. He should have gone to jail. He did not because of some technicalities, but he should have gone to jail.
He himself, though, was not a member of the Ku Klux Klan, though, contrary to popular belief, though. correct?
It's hard to know because they kept these membership lists secret. We have some membership lists. We have a fair number of membership lists, but so far no one is able to say that I'm aware of that Jackson absolutely was a member of the Klan. But it doesn't really matter because he and Stevenson were buddies. At his inauguration in early 1925, Stevenson stood next to Jackson. They were big buddies all through these years and close associates. He took money from Stevenson. He used his car. Stevenson lent him one of his many cars to campaign around the state. A close, close alliance.
We're talking with retired IU history professor Jim Madison about his new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland. And since this is an encore presentation of a show we aired last month, we can't take your questions and comments live today, but we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the show and what we should cover next. We're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're re-airing our conversation with retired IU history professor Jim Madison. He's the author of the new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland. Since this is an encore presentation, we can't get questions or comments in front of our guests, but you can still let us know what you think on our social media platforms. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. So, Jim Madison, we were talking just before the break about the election of Ed Jackson, the Klan-friendly governor, in 1924. He took office in 1925. But was there influence, did the Klan have influence on not just the governor, but also the Indiana General Assembly as well?
Absolutely. It's likely, again, hard to know for sure, but very likely. But the majority of members of the Indiana General Assembly that took their seats in 1925, early 25, were either Klan members or very sympathetic to the Klan. And they had a program. They had a set of legislation that they were going to pass, enact. Much of it was anti-Catholic, directed against parochial schools, against nuns in schools, but other measures as well. Very powerful, and it looked like they were going to enact their program. They failed to do that. All sorts of complications there I won't bore listeners with. They failed, but they were going to come back again because this was just the beginning of Klan power in Indiana, Stevenson and other leaders assumed.
But very soon after that, that same year, 1925, D.C. Stevenson, well, his downfall began, and you mentioned Madge Oberholzer earlier in the show. What happened?
Well, the brutalization and murder of Madge Oberholzer resulted in a public trial in Noblesville, which brought out all sorts of sordid details. I mean, it was a real challenge for newspaper writers to report the trial because of the indelicacy of describing what information came out in the trial. It made Stevenson look like the most evil man in Indiana in 1925. And a jury of 12 Hamilton County men convicted him, and he went off to the penitentiary, as we said earlier. That's not good for the Klan, for an organization with its goals and its purposes. And so Stevenson's downfall in late 1925 causes people to doubt and even to flee the Klan. But I want to be quick to say here, Matt, that Stevenson's downfall is not the downfall of the Klan because the organization continues to have a presence and a power for the next 3 or 4 years in Indiana.
Can you illustrate that that power? Because there was a sharp, there seemed to be a sharp decline in the group's influence after D.C. Stevenson's conviction and after he went to prison, but you say that it was more of a slow fade.
I think it was a slow, very slow, painfully slow, rather than sharp. And there's all sorts of efforts on the part of Klan leaders and the Republican Party leadership to regroup and to come back. And they continued to stay in power. The best example or illustration of that are the 1928 elections, when the Republican Party, with its Klan allegiances, gained victories again across the state. And the few Republican candidates who stood up to the Klan, the Attorney General in particular from South Bend, lost in that Republican election. So the Klan Republican Alliance continues to work until through 1928. It finally falls apart in the local elections in 1929, when Democratic candidates, anti-Klan candidates, sweep into office. That's a long time between Stevenson's downfall in 1925 and the downfall of the Klan as an organization. By 1930, I think we can say the Ku Klux Klan is pretty much dead in Indiana.
What about Governor Jackson? I mean, D.C. Stevenson's conviction and his prison sentence all happened within the first year of his term, and that began the downfall of the Klan. What were the next 3 years like for Governor Jackson?
It was a tough time for Governor Jackson. It was a tough time because Stevenson assumed that his good friend Governor Jackson would pardon him soon after he settled into the Michigan City pen. Jackson didn't do that. Stevenson said, "I've got evidence. I'm going to release it if you don't do something." Jackson didn't. So Stevenson started to release the little black boxes in which he had stored checks and receipts and correspondence and documents. He started to release them to the press. And of course, the press had a field day with his information because it indicated all sorts of leaders, all sorts of political leaders, who had taken money from the Klan, who had worked with the Klan, including Ed Jackson. Ed Jackson is eventually indicted and tried for corruption, for bribery. He's still governor of Indiana. He's exonerated on a technicality. He refuses to resign. He appears at the Republican State Convention in 1928 after this trial, intending to speak. The leaders adjourn before he gets a chance to speak. So he's a pariah within the Republican Party by this time.
Okay, so the Klan is the Klan that we're speaking of primarily, the Klan of the late teens through the 20s, is pretty well dead by 1930.
Yes, yes.
But it then is revived in the 1960s, though not to the same degree as the 1920s. And the reason, of course, is the civil rights era.
Right.
What did that Klan look like?
May I just go back and finish one quick point?
Please.
That we didn't get to talk about, Matt, in this 1920s Klan, and that is there was opposition from the very beginning, not just students at Notre Dame, but from the Catholic Church, which organized, published a newspaper, from Jewish Hoosiers, from African Americans who revived their NAACP branches, from some newspaper editors, not enough, from some politicians, not enough, from other ordinary Hoosiers who say, wait a minute, this is not Indiana, this is not American ideals. But the tragedy here is that so many remain silent, so many joined the Klan, and so many remain silent. So this organization of bigotry had a longer run than we now wish it would. It did come back in the 60s, but it's a very different organization in the 1960s. It is entirely directed towards stopping the civil rights movement, which really offends certain Hoosiers. It is entirely directed toward white supremacy. It is very small in numbers. And so when the Klan has a rally and shows up in Fort Wayne or Indianapolis or Kokomo, there are always many more protesters than Klan members. There are always more police and media, police to protect the Klan. It is a bunch of really ne'er-do-wells, ignorant, unsophisticated people. Unlike the Klan members of the 20, who were quite well off, many of them middle class, good lawyers and doctors and professional people and good farmers, the Klan that comes back in the 60s is nothing like that. They're the great unteachables, the great unwashed. They persist, especially in the 70s, 80s, into the 90s. There's a little bit of sign of them occasionally today, But their presence today is not usually in white sheets, in robes and hoods. It's in other ways that we can see even today. Some of the ideals of the Ku Klux Klan expressed in Indiana and expressed in America.
And indeed, I mean, I guess one of the more recent examples is Matthew Heimbach, who is not a member of the Ku Klux Klan, but who is or was a Paoli resident, who helped to organize the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. You write a little about him in the book.
I did. I got interested in Matt Heimbach. I wish I could interview him and talk to him. A smart guy. I'm sorry to say he was a history major, not at IU, not even at Purdue, but he's a smart guy. He's educated. And like a lot of the young white supremacists today, he knows how to communicate in the modern forms. He had his own radio program for a while. He traveled in Europe, meeting white supremacists in Europe. This guy is not an ignorant rube. He's smart. And he was very, very active in the late teens, particularly in organizing the Charlottesville rally in 2017. I have a picture of him in full battle gear from that Charlottesville rally. He's a force for evil. And he's the modern version of the Klan, not in white robes, often in military dress, but also in pressed blue shirts and silk blouses. There are people today using the same kind of coded language, even the same words, as the Klan used in the 1920s.
Is violence among the goals of today's racist movements as it was in the 1960s, or is it a little more careful, I suppose?
Well, the Klan in the 60s and 70s, the Klan led by Indiana Grand Dragon William Cheney, were a bunch of nincompoops. But they did have guns and they did have dynamite. They bombed a black market in Bloomington, Indiana. They engaged in other kinds of violence, but they were really kind of stumble bums. The folks today are a little more sophisticated. In fact, a lot more sophisticated. And I believe they do present a danger through their use of violence, their willingness to do violence. Some of them are the great unwashed. It looks like the Michigan militia boys were of that sort. But some of them, the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo, some of the others today who are speaking words of hatred very close to the Klan of the 1920s, are also talking about violence and willing to engage in violence. So the dangers to the American nation from groups like this, I think, are a significant issue in our time, in our day.
You're, of course, a retired professor of history from IU, and there is a mural on the wall of a classroom at IU Bloomington that got a lot of attention in recent years, and I guess has over the years gotten attention sort of in waves because of its depiction of the Klan. Can you tell us a bit about that mural?
That's a mural by Thomas Hart Benton. It's in Woodburn Hall, and I taught in that classroom every fall, usually to 400-plus students. I love that classroom because I love that mural. It has a picture of the Klan. Now, the facts of the case are that it depicts, Benton drew, painted a Roman Catholic church and Klan members walking in front of the Roman Catholic church as an accurate indicator of the anti-Catholicism of the Klan in the 1920s. More importantly, Benton's mural is an attack on the Klan. It is an anti-Klan mural. However, this Klan is such a hot potato, and the myths and the misinformation around it add to the difficulties of talking about it, of confronting it, of dealing with it in a reasonable way. And so a fair number of students, and I'm not criticizing the students here, sat in that classroom, forced to be in the presence of that mural, and presumed that it was offensive, that it was supporting the Klan, and there were controversies for years about this mural. I always rather liked them because at least you could tell that students were thinking about something of significance when they opposed the Benton mural. Eventually, and I write about this story in the book, the university decided that they had to close the classroom because it was just too difficult to deal with the anger, the emotions, the trauma that this mural caused. I do want to say here, Matt, the Klan, the imagery of the Klan the associations the Klan brings up do cause trauma. They do cause emotional reactions. And that's especially true for African Americans who have stories in their families handed down from generations of Klan action and Klan-like action. And that trauma is real. That trauma is serious. That trauma is part of the divisions and the struggles that our nation is going through now.
But do you think that that trauma can be mitigated with context? I'm sure that when you taught in that classroom where that mural still hangs, that you offered context. But I'm sure that there were countless other lectures held in that room where there was no context for what was on the wall. Do you think that was part of the problem?
That was absolutely part of the problem. And you're absolutely right, because professors in physics or health and safety usually didn't have the context to provide to students. And that's a major part of our challenge now. I'm exceedingly biased. I'm a historian, but I believe we need a lot more history in our lives, in our public squares. We need to understand where our problems came from, not just the Klan, but all the issues and problems have deep historical context. You can't just parachute in and begin to have an informed opinion without knowing the origins, the context in which these issues have been developed. And the kind of history we need is not the patriotic history that has been called for. It's not comfort history. It's not sweeping these stories under the carpet, pretending, for example, we never had a Klan in Indiana, or if we had a Klan in the 20s, it was a marginal group. Klan in the 20s, I believe, was a mainstream group, not a marginal group. We can't pretend this didn't happen. We can't airbrush it. We have to face it honestly. We're citizens. We're adults in a democracy. We can't deal with bedtime stories of the kind of patriotic history proposed from certain quarters.
Got just about a minute and a half left. We've gone through a lot of what the book covers, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland. And again, it's out now if you'd like to read it. What context can we take from what you've found, specifically, I guess, looking at the 1920s and the Klan's heyday? What I guess, is the most important thing readers should take away from this?
Well, I think the message is the past is not dead. The past lives. We are connected to our past. We may not know it, we may not understand it, but we are deeply connected to our past. That's especially true in Indiana, where our past is a powerful presence. Hoosiers don't change rapidly. We may not understand our past, but we have it sort of in our DNA. We're reluctant to adopt new ways. And sometimes that's good, sometimes it's not. But it means that our past in Indiana is even more powerful in laying out the paths ahead, in giving us the alternatives to make choices as citizens. I'm very concerned about democracy in our own time, more than I've been in my entire life. I'm concerned about the people of Indiana and America as democratic citizens in a democratic nation. And I think we need to have more attention to that, to the American ideals laid down by our founding fathers. If they did not live up to them, of course, they did not. Neither do we. But they are there. They're the great blessing. You know, our greatest Hoosier of all time, Abe Lincoln, said that America is the last best hope of earth. And I'd like to still believe that.
Jim Madison is a professor emeritus of history at Indiana University and the author of the new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland. Jim Madison, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Join us tomorrow for a conversation with the author of the new book, No Place Like Murder, True Crime in the Midwest. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.